Let's see. Okay, I think it's recording now.
Okay.
So today's date is February the 5th, 2025. My name is Jonathan Gerland, and I'm in the home of Steve Cole today in Lufkin, and we're going to do an oral history interview, and I think we'll focus on some of his experiences in the East Texas lignite strip mining activities. But let's just start with when and where you were born.
I was born in Port Arthur, Texas, but actually we lived in Winnie, Texas, south of Winnie. But my mother would go to the hospital. You know, there was 11. She had 11 kids. I'm the second oldest, oldest son. You know, so and she was widowed when she was 41. Still had seven minors, and I was 22, and I stepped in and took over at 22.
Took over what?
The 2,000 acre rice farm.
2,000 acres.
Acre, yes. Okay. Yeah, in the marsh. Pretty tough farming down there. You know, at sea level.
Is that your dad? Your dad?
He developed that. Yes, okay. He did. He was way ahead of his curve. He went down that marsh and kind of like you do in Holland. He got him a drag line and he started digging ditches and building levees, and he got the water rights on a bio that run through there so he could pump water to irrigate the rice.
About where was it located?
10 miles south of Winnie Stoll, Texas. Presently, right now, the farm, the 2,000 acres, borders the eastern side of the Anahuac National Wildlife Refuge. Okay. That's the best way to tell people where it's at. It's on FM 1985, about 2 miles west of State Highway 124, which goes to Hyle and Galveston.
Yeah. Okay. So did you live there?
Okay. Grew up. No, when I got married, I lived in Winnie. But my daddy built a new place there when I was 14. Okay. And that's where I stayed until I went off to college. And then when I got married, I lived in Winnie.
Where did you go to college?
Texas A&M.
Okay.
But
I dropped out.
I started out as mechanical engineering, but I realized I was way over my head. And I switched to industrial technology, which is kind of a watered-down engineering course.
Okay.
And, you know, I thought I didn't need to know anything about farming, and I need to know about engineering. So, yeah. But
you got called to farming.
I dropped out about midway my sophomore year. You know, and so, because I was afraid that he was going to lose the farm because he was in bad health and he was going downhill. And I was afraid if I stayed to get a degree, time I got back, there wouldn't be no farm. And I was in love with farming. I'm a farmer at heart today, all right? You know, but I've been a seed slicker for the last 40 years.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about rice farming.
Well, rice farming, you know, you use a lot of water. We planted...
fresh water.
Yeah, fresh water, yeah. And you can plant in the water in a wet year if you can't get the land worked it. Plus, back in the before herbicides, we would use we call mudding in, and we'd use that to get we would work it up like a big mud pie in the water, and then we'd sprout the seed in a sack. And we'd put a sack of rice in a canal, let it soak for 24 hours. We'd do a whole truckload like that, all right, if you had 100 acres. And then we'd put it in the barn and cover it with a tarp, and it would germinate for 24 hours. And every seed in that sack would get a little pip on it, a little root, And then we'd take an airplane and fly it and drop it in that water, and it would go down and hit that mud pie, and we'd immediately turn the water off. In 3 days, you'd have a little green leaf. Well, that means you had to jump on the grass. The idea is to get the rice up high enough that you can put water over it to smother the grass, not smother the rice. So that's how you control the grass back before herbicides.
Controlling the sunlight.
If you get a jump on that rice and get that stem up that high, and the grass is only this high,
right,
you can cover the grass with water and drown it.
Keeping the competition.
Well, you don't cultivate like you do cotton, you know, or row crops. So that was before herbicides. Now that we've got herbicides, you don't have to do that. You can plant dry and let it come up and then spray this herbicide and kill the grass, all right?
So who was your market?
Well, first you would dry it. You would cut it to, I think, around 18% moisture, some 20% moisture. You take it to a rice dryer. They would run it through a dryer process and bring the moisture down to 12%, like that. And then you'd sell it to a buyer like a rice mill in Beaumont or at Houston. They'd come around it so often at the local co-op, and you'd bring your sample up there, you know, from the dryer, and they would rub it out on the board, and then they would offer you a price, and you could take it or reject it, all right? So, and then they would take it, and it still has a hole on it. So they take it out, and then they mill it, and then they polish it, what they do, and put in a package and sell it to you. So our deal ended at the rice dryer. Now, we did own a rice dryer, which is in this book. My daddy and his cousin and his uncle built on it in the 50s, in 52. It was the tallest building in the county, with elevator. Anyhow.
So what year did you graduate high school?
58.
And where did you go to high school?
They call it East Chambers, but it's Winningstool. East Chambers is the east side of Chambers County, all right?
Okay.
We're right on the county line with Jefferson County.
So talk a little bit more about some of the activities. We were talking earlier about fish. You stocked catfish.
Okay. Well, I took over the farm when I was 22, and I had 3 good years. I mean, I was just not going to hide off the ball, you know. And I was dealing with the local Production Credit Association Bank, which was a farmer's bank, you know. I was the youngest member in there and had the largest loan outstanding, all right? And I was driving the guy crazy because I was always, you know, aggressive. And we, you know, like I say, for a 22-year-old, that's, you know, he was nervous. So anyhow, my brother's in the Air Force, and he got out of the Air Force in 66, and so I wanted him to come back and help me, but we also wanted to increase our revenue. You know, we wanted to. So we looked at sugar cane, we looked at sorghum, and we went up to Arkansas looking at soybeans, you know. And so as we drive, we talked to the guys up there this wintertime, January, and as we're driving down the road to get to the main highway, we pull up on the main highway and we see this big sign across the road says, Federal Fish Hatchery, Bureau of Commercial Fisheries. I told my brother Lawrence, I said, let's go over and talk to these people, because Daddy had a 500-acre reservoir the lowest part of our farm. He just used it for a reservoir to store water. So, but Hurricane Carla in 61 wiped it clean, all the vegetation clean. Just, you know, we had a bass lake, and we had a bass in there, and we would sell permits by the year to doctors and, you know,
for people, bass fishing.
Yeah, bass fishing. Well known that time. But all that was over after Carla just denuded. So I go over and I figured they're going to tell me how to bring it back with grass and all this stuff. And so I got all my aerial maps and I'm unrolling them and showing them all this stuff. And we had a pretty elaborate water system, drainage, levees. And they said, man, forget about bass. You want to raise catfish. And I said, oh, get out of here, man. I'm not interested in that. And they kept hammering on me about it. After about 3 or 4 hours, I said, all right, show me one guy that's doing it. Because we were on our way out of there because there was a blizzard coming. So they told me, the guy Dumas, Arkansas, they called and said, these guys are coming by. Talk to them. So we left there in about an hour or so later. Now, what's unusual, and it's in this book, we're on a state highway, a federal highway, I believe, in Arkansas, and we got to get on this barge to cross this Arkansas River. And the landing, there ain't no landing. You come down this sand bank, and they let a little ramp off that barge, and it don't hold 6 cars, all right? And we get on that barge and go across that river, and there's a sand bank up the other side. This was in 1966. So we get to, this guy's name was Edgar Farmer, and we get there, and it's getting kind of late in the afternoon, and we're driving up it. Road to this house, and I see all these ponds. I see a cat D7 pushing more ponds. I said, there's more to this than I realized. So we got up there and got to talk to him, and he was a rice farmer, cotton farmer, and a fisherman. So we had some common ground. We could talk, because I could talk rice, he could talk rice. The problem was, I go to bragging on my yield, I talk in barrels. He goes bragging on his yield, he talk in bushels, and we get all confused, you know. But anyhow. I told him, I said, we got to get out of here because this blizzard's coming. I can't get froze in here because my wife's in the hospital. She just had a baby, and she was going to be in there 10 days because the baby was born premature. But she was okay, and that's why we left her, right? Because she was going to be there 10 days. So we head out of there that night. Sure enough, we wind up in Biloxi, the Mississippi, next morning about 2 or 3 o'clock, and we wake up about noon. and it's ice all the way back, you know, to float to. So we get, so yeah, 30 days later we go back and we go taking more notes, you know. And then we get into catfish business, and at 66 and 67 we have a pay lake. That's where you let people come in for a dollar a head and 50 cents a pound, all right? We did that one year because...
Did fish with rods and reels?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So did you make new ponds for the
fish? Yeah, yeah, yeah. We had this 2,000 acres. And what you do is we build these levees around, which we already had a lot of anyhow. We call them road dragline dumps. In other words, it'd be a levee 5 foot high with, say, a 12-foot top that you could drive on. You see what I'm saying? Around 100 acres or 50 acres. So we had all that, a lot of that done. So we could flood 100 acres or 50 acres. So we could farm fish 1 year and rice the next if you wanted to, all right?
So how deep was it? Like 4 or 5 feet?
Yeah, 3 foot deep. But then around one side or maybe one end, you'd have a barred ditch, you know, where you took the dirt to build that levee.
It'd be deeper there.
Yeah, so then in the wintertime, they wouldn't freeze. They could get down that barred ditch, you know, or get. So that's what we did. We just flooded that. The problem we had was pumping out of a bayou, and we had to filter the water through a saran, like a parachute cloth, to try and take out any trash eggs or stuff like that, you know. And that's kind of hard to do when you got a 30-inch pipe, diameter pipe, you know, it's flowing in pretty good volume. But anyhow, we had to pay lake 1 year. We didn't do it the next year because the dirt road to it, when it rained, people get...
You're saying a pay lake.
Pay lake.
Would pay lake.
They pay $1 a head to get in and 50 cents a pound for what they catch. We didn't do it the next year because we had this dirt road going down there, and when it rained, they get stuck down there. But that was in 67. Well, in 68, well, we harvested that pond in the Christmas weekend of 67. And it's in here, and it's described as how not to harvest catfish, all right? From that, we learned some things, and we built some portable haul wagons instead of building flat. The guys in Arkansas, Mississippi, they would take their flatbed truck and build water boxes on it. Well, you can't go down a dragline dump with a high center of gravity dual axle truck if the road is halfway wet, all right? Where you had these tractors we had, we took some 36-inch gas line pipe, half-inch wall, cut a 30-foot chunk out of it and plugged up the ends like a barbecue pit, put an axle under it and hooked it to our three-point lift on our tractor and cut holes in top and put a circulating system on it. And then we, on the rear, we had a 12-inch 90-degree valve elbow with a pressure cooker lid. We'd fill that thing with live catfish. And we got to where we were going to want to turn them loose. We had a chute, a portable chute, just lay on the side of the bank. We'd line that chute up with that valve at 90-degree turn, undo that pressure cooker lid, 12-inch diameter, and raise the tractor at the same time. And we could unload 3,000 pounds of fish in 45 seconds and not kill them, not hurt them, fish, water, and all. So we built three of those, had one coming, one going, one load. And then we developed a basket to dip them out of the net with. So again, we're in touch with these guys in Arkansas at the commercial fish deal, and they're complaining to us about these farmers in Arkansas, because the federal government had developed the same 40-acre lake, all right? And they had the barge to carry it on, the ropes to pull it with, the winch truck to winch it with. They had the whole 9 yards. But they're complaining to us because up in Arkansas, Mississippi, they're seeing a 40-acre lake and got all these fish up, and it takes these farmers 2 weeks to get them out there because they're hauling them up and down the bank with wash tubs, all right, you know? So we got these wagons perfected and this dip bass perfected, and I called them. And I said, you know, y'all been complaining about, can't get the fish out of the net. I said, if you'll come down here, I'll show you. We got it figured out. But I don't have a seine. You got the seine.
Seine,
yeah. 3,000-foot seine. And the barge, it was an aluminum barge and all that. So I said, Cole, we're a federal deal. We can't be going off down there. You know, they take two or three trucks and two or three people and haul 400 miles. We got to have a reason for going down there. Can you have a field day? I said, yeah, we can have that. So we called the TV station in Houston, Ag Reporter, you know. We had 100 people show up. VIP, I mean, fish hatchery people from four states, all right? And we had never done this, you know? I'm 20. At that time, I'm 28. My brother's 26. So what we did, because this was a 100-acre lake, and we only had sand for 40 acres, my brother's in charge of the fish. We fed the fish on one side where there was no bar ditch. You had the land just run right up to the levee. Now, fish are like hogs. They hear that feeder coming. You know, we had a 4020 John Deere turning a, looked like a fertilizer distributor with a big cotton gin blower. It throw feet out there 150 feet, you know, pellets. And they hear the thing whining, and you can see them, the water moving, you know. So we fed them, and then we took that same barge and laid out that seine out there the evening before, okay? Now, this is all on film on my Facebook. So the next morning we get out there, it takes about 3 hours to pull that seine in, all right? Just winching it in, you know? And it's getting closer and closer, and there's not a ripple on that water. And my banker's there, and the TV people are there. I said, this ain't going to be pretty if we pull that seine in. There ain't no fish in it. Well, that seine gets out there. I mean, it's not 100 foot from the shore, you know? And they got people standing there on top of the tractor fenders and everything, and some guy jumps off on them tractor fenders, which is about 6 foot high. They will get some coffee or a cigarette. And when he hit the ground, you ever seen a covey of quail just explode? That water just exploded because the fish felt that vibration. Ooh, I said, we got a few anyhow, you know? So sure enough, we stopped. Wasn't too much long, we stopped. And then we went in that same small seine, and we'd bring in 5,000 pounds or whatever. Within 2 hours, we had moved 22,000 pounds of fish without hurting them. The key is to move them to another pond and turn them loose without skinning them up. It's like working cattle. You don't skin your cattle up every time you move them from one pasture to the other, see? So, and it worked like clockwork. I mean, those professional fish hatchery managers just blew their mind that they'd never seen anything like that. And here we were. We were kids. Now, we thought we were adults, but we were kids, and we didn't have a biology degree or a fishery degree. We were just solving some problems, all right? Well, this was all on TV in Houston, and, you know, and this is what attracted this buyer come out there and wave his money in our face, all right? So the catfish, like years later, my brother and I sat around and said, you know, talk about after my daddy died, had we sat around the table and come up with a scheme on how to put lipstick on a pig to sell that farm, we couldn't have done it better than what we did. It was an accident, you see what I'm saying? And anyhow, so the catfish allowed me to make a graceful exit from the rice business. Whether you know it or not, rice is disappearing from the Gulf Coast after 150 years, all right? And
why is that?
The only thing, now it's in Arkansas, they're going like gangbusters. The only thing I can figure out is that the margins are so close that in Arkansas, you got cotton, you got soybeans, you got rice, and you might even have fish up there. But so if you buy a tractor for $300,000 and one of them don't make, you can pay the note with maybe the other two, all right? You see what I'm saying? You get two or three kisses at the pig. Where down here, it's rice and that's it. If you don't make it, you lose one crop and it's over. Used to, back in the old days, you made enough money that you could put salt some way. And so if you had a bad year, but now the margins is just, and so a lot of my neighbors went broke, you know, and it's going back to cattle the way it was before rice was there, you know. But it's a shame because the big rice dryer my dad and them built, 100-foot tall, big tanks, just falling down. All the rice dryers in that area just gone. Either falling, it's steel, so it's falling down. The concrete ones, they just left them there or they imploded them. But all that infrastructure is just going to hell. It's a shame. You know, all.
And, did your rice business have a name or just a family name? Or
I went by Cole Farms. That's the name I hung
Cole
on.
Cole Farms.
Yeah, that's what I did. This is a business card I had. I printed this in like when I got the catfish business. No, you can have that. It's got a recipe inside.
Rice and catfish.
Yeah.
Eat more rice and catfish.
Yeah. That's a Cubillon. It's like a shrimp Creole.
Yeah.
It works.
It's got a recipe inside.
Yes. Yeah. You serve it on rice.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, how'd you get into the equipment sales business?
Well, there was a detour. When I left, when we was in the catfish business, there was a guy in Beaumont that had three burger restaurants called Burger King. I think, Burger Kitchen. And he showed up out there one day at my place and said, look, I've got competition moving in on me, Burger King, McDonald's, Burger Chef, and I'm going downhill. He said, I want to convert over to all-you-can-eat catfish. He grew up around Texarkana, and there used to be a big one up there somewhere, and he remembered it. So he said, can you sell me catfish? I said, yeah. So within 30 days, he converts this thing over. Bam. And so I'm feeding him this catfish, and he's making money from day one. Then he opens the second one, converts another one. Well, first thing you know, I'm realizing I don't have enough fish to take care of this guy. He don't know that. Well, I can't let him die on the vine. So at that time, we had formed a trade association called Catfish Farmers America. It was out of Greenville, Mississippi, and I was one of the founding members of it. I was the youngest one on it, but yeah, I was secretary or something. So I finally fessed up and said, Everett, look, his name was Everett Jones. I said, Everett, look, I don't have no fish to take care of you year round, but I said, I will take you and introduce you to some people that do have enough fish, knowing that I'd lose him, once I so sure. So we flew up there and I introduced him to all my buddies up in Mississippi and Arkansas, and sure enough. So anyhow, a year or so later, we sell this farm. And he asked me, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. He said, why don't you go in the rest of the business? I said, all right. I said, if you give me the Dallas-Fort Worth franchise, I will. I'll be a franchisee under you. So that's what I did. I went to opened a place in Garland and then opened one in Arlington. And
what was it called?
It started off as Farmer Boy's Catfish Kitchen. That was the name he was operating under. And once I got into it after a year or two, I said, man, this thing's got, it's not my plan was to build 10, 12, 15 in Dallas here and have a commissary in the middle, but it was a management, it was a killer to operate that thing. And so I was down at the Texas Restaurant Association convention in Austin, and they had a speaker down there that was owner and manager of the Nighthawk restaurant in Austin named Giles Spiller. So I talked to him. I said, Giles, and he was a consultant too. And I said, I want you to come to Dallas, Garland, spend 2 or 3 days looking at my place and tell me what the hell to do. This thing is killing us. So he did. He came down in about 3 days. He said, Cole, your deal is too complicated. Colonel, Kentucky Fried Chicken didn't get where he is. Your system's got to be stronger than the manager. Your system, you got to have a manager stronger than the system because it's so complicated, all right? And you can't build a chain around that kind of product. So that's your problem. So once he told me that, I had suspected that something like that was. But see, Everett Jones was a workaholic. He loved working 7 days a week, and it didn't bother him, So I wanted to change to something like you remember Western Sizzling? When they came to town, they had a line you go through and they had boards up there. You pick your thing and you tell them, and then they give you a number. You go to the table, and then when your deal comes up, the little gal brings it out. She doesn't have to take your order. You interact up there at the front, see? So you eliminate the waitresses, basically, all right? So I wanted to clean it up and do that. Well, he wasn't interested in that, so I said, well, I was going to go on my own. I just quit paying him royalties and changed it to Cajun catfish. Well, when I opened that second place in Arlington, I went over because they had beer. See, in Garland, you couldn't have beer back in the 70s. Well, I went to Arlington. Well, you got to realize, at that time, there wasn't no baseball team. Six Flags shut down when school started, all right? I mean, they rolled the sidewalks up over there after. You only had 3 months, that you could do anything. And I was warned about that by 2 or 3 people. I said, oh, man, don't worry about it. You told me I couldn't go to Garland, and I made it. I'm sure enough unaware, and I busted my butt, in Arlington. So I retreated back to Garland, and that's when I, you know, decided that, hey, this ain't what I want to do for a living. But I was being about 4 years at that time, and I was 34 years old, and I had this buddy that come by, I went to high school with, and he was selling machinery and driving this big company car. He always had a lot of money in his pocket. He's shooting pool half a day and drinking beer and at the lake every weekend, you know. And I'm down here working my butt off 7 days a week. I said, something wrong with this picture, you know. I need to be doing what he's doing. So that's what I did. I walked away from that restaurant and went to work for nothing, basically, with that four small kids. I'd never worked for anybody in my life. Within 30 months, I changed jobs five times. And I went from $10,000 a year to $60,000 a year. And I was considered an expert in my field in 30 months. And that's because I got into mining business. Nobody knew anything about it. And the customer took me under his wing and mentored me. Because he could see that I was willing to think outside the box.
So who did you work for?
I started off with J.W. Bartholomew Machinery.
Say that a little slower for the recording. Okay.
J.W. Bartholomew Machinery Company in Dallas. It had been probably the oldest machinery company in Dallas at that time. Very conservative, you know. So there's four salesmen. I'm the junior one.
As in 75?
Yes.
Okay.
I had a 6-week stint somewhere else, I could tell you about it. You may not want to hear about it, but yeah. I wouldn't have left there if they hadn't dropped me. But yeah, I went to work for the first place I went to work was for Case, J.I. Case, before Bartholomew. It's a trainee for, going to be a field territory trainee, you know, Case tractors and combine. In the Dallas office. And you had to get a lot of resumes and a lot of people to swear you were a good guy and all that. And I passed all those tests and got in there. And I'd been there 6 weeks and I was doing good. And a letter come out of Racine, Wisconsin, which is the headquarters, saying, due to the recession, the downturn, cut the trainee program. They're paying me $200 a week. I still got to my restaurant. And I break down and cry over a $300 a week job because I was so unsure of myself and I was so happy to be on with a major corporation because they were going to put me down and, you know, covering 10 dealers or something and working with them. So anyhow, so I wound up going to work for this Bartholomew. He said, we don't pay much. I said, well, I can't expect much because I don't have experience. Well, this is where he gave me the ready-mix accounts in 54 counties, the high-rise builders like Sam Wallace, H.C. Beck's, you know, Austin Industries, people like that. And then he threw in the utility company, the power companies. And I asked him, I said, Jim, I said, why are you giving me the power companies? I'm the junior salesman. He said, I'm giving them to you because these other three guys, they don't want to deal with the bureaucracy that's associated with the utility companies. So I'm driving my territory, you know, out there, 54 counties, and I see these dragline booms, you know, swinging, but you can't get in there, you know. And so after about 9 months, I get this, someone, you know, these little cards, they tear out magazines, it's, if you're interested in something, we call them bingo cards. Some engineer from over here at this Martin Lake mine, named Chad Abernathy, sent in this bingo card, wanted information on a Gorman Rupp pump. That was the smallest item I had in my catalog, all right? And man, I had a name and a phone number and a request. And I called him, I said, I'm coming to see you and cover you up with information, answering all your questions. So I go to see Chad over here. They let me in the gate, you know, and all that stuff. After I get through him, I said, Chad, look, I can't figure out who to call on Dallas. I don't even know where the headquarters is for this outfit or who to call on. He could tell me where the headquarters was, but he didn't know who to call on. But he said, go up here to Mount Pleasant Mine and talk to Benny Woods, and Benny can tell you. So next day I call Benny and make an appointment, go up and see Benny. And he tells me a name in Dallas, Cliff Irwin. So I call Cliff Irwin, too, who I am. I come see him. Cliff's an ex-high school teacher, math teacher. Real nice, easygoing guy. And they're looking for help. Because, you know, overnight they get into this humongous earth-moving enterprise, and they're electrical people, all right? and they're needing equipment manufacturers to modify some of the equipment or design new equipment to help improve their efficiency, you know.
And this, just for the recording, this is for the fuel for the power plants.
They consider this a fuel division. They didn't talk about being in a coal mine, but they had a natural gas division, all right, pipeline, storage. That was a fuel division. This was tantamount to that. They were going to get, this is a fuel source to feed their power plants, all right?
Lignite coal.
Lignite. Yeah. And this is surface mine. This is not underground. This is surface mine. And so overnight, these guys got the biggest earth-moving project in the Western Hemisphere, and they're trying to tune and tweak it. And they're using some of the equipment that's been designed 100 years ago, the old shovels, you know, cable shovels. And I took the position as a problem solver. I said, all right. As I told you, most salesmen will come in there and say, I got this widget. I want you to buy my widget. I went in there and said, what are your problems? Tell me what you need solved, and we'll see if maybe we can do something about it, you know. Well, he had a whole list of them. The one I focused on, they wanted to try hydraulic backhoes, all right, a track hole, you know, and work from the top of the seam where they dig down, and the truck runs on the seam with them, and they load the truck. And they use the seam as a highway, all right. They were presently sitting below the seam at the bottom, and the shovel was digging up, and the truck was having to run in the bottom in the mud, all right? See? Well, the problem was they had 16-yard shovels. That time, it just so happened, my boss sent me to the, we were the Coring Excavate, Coring, K-O-E-H-R-I-N-G. They were known tobacco people at that time. They had just come out with the world's largest. It was an 8-yard. Now, it's half the size of what they needed, but it was big enough that they could try it out and see if the concept worked, all right? Well, I had gone to my boss, Jim Bright, sent me another salesman to the Coring School in Milwaukee, and I saw this big machine. So I come back and I told Cliff, I said, Cliff, I got with the dealer, with this biggest machine in the world now. There's not one of them west of the Mississippi River yet. I said, we can bring that in here and try it, the concept, and see if it worked. He said, you're right, Steve. He said, now, here's the deal. We'll pay you $30,000 a month for 6 months. You know, we'll pay you $180,000 for you to demo that machine. If it works, we'll buy it. If you don't, you got to take it back. Well, I knew better than to go into Bartholow. Not Jim Bright, the sales manager, but the owner of the company. He was conservative, and tell him to invest in $500,000 a machine where they wouldn't have west of the Mississippi River yet under these terms, all right? So I told Cliff, I said, Cliff, I know how to get this handled. He said, my company ain't going to do it, but here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to the president of the Coring Company in Milwaukee and explain to him the size and importance of your account and get him to give a machine to Bartholow Machinery with no recall, you know, that if it comes back, they take it back. But I said, now here's the deal, Cliff. I got all these notes I've been taking from you, but this is the biggest thing in the world and all these numbers. But I said, if I go to Milwaukee with all these numbers and go whipping them over the head about how big this project is, they're going to listen to me about 10 minutes and tell me to give his text to Enma and put him on the next bus south, because if this project was this big, we'd know about it, all right? So I said, I need some pictures so I can show him the drag line, I can show him the shovel and the truck and the trimming and the power plant and let him know, you know, that these numbers I'm hitting him with are for real, you know. I said, I got it. So at this time, they didn't allow anybody to take pictures, all right? He takes me to Mount Pleasant. We leave real early one morning. We spend the whole day over. I burn up 15, 20 rolls of film, you know, just getting pictures. And I put together this slide presentation. And I had these charts, you know, made. So... Now, I told my boss, Jim Bride, I said, Jim, I'm working on something, but I'm not ready to show you what I'm doing. So when I got it all put together, I didn't tell my boss. So I told him, I said, all right, Jim, I'm ready to show it to you, but I don't want to show it to you but on Saturday. He said, why? I said, because on Saturday we're closed and you're unoccupied. So sure enough, I take my projector and slide projector and go in there and show it to him, and you can tell he's stunned, you know. He said, we got to show this Jack. Well, Jack is the owner, Jack Bartholow. Jack's in his 60s and real negative. I said, all right, but again, I want you to run a hotel room down the street. Why? I said, I don't want Jack to be interfered with while I'm showing this, you know, because you know, he wouldn't pay attention while the phone's ringing. So sure enough, he told Jack this, and Jack grumbled, but they did it. So I go down and I show this to Jack and Jim there, and Jack asked me two or three negative questions, and he gets up and walks out. And I'm thinking it didn't go over well. Once he gets down out of here, this Jim said, "Boy, he went for it." I said, "You couldn't tell it by me." So we get back to the office, and Jack has a little room within a room, you know, with a glass wall. You can see, kind of like a bullpen. And the door shut, but you can see through the window. And he's screaming at somebody on the phone. He says, "What do you mean you can't get here to Thursday? This is bigger than both of us." He has the president of the corn company on the phone and screaming at him. This is Tuesday, I think, because the guy can't get here till Thursday. So I knew then that Jack had bought the deal. So the president, Ken Chandler, I think his name was, he says, look, I got three vice presidents going to be at the Astrodome. They're at the Astrodome right now at the big rock show. They had the ConAgra or something going on, Concrete and Agri show. He said, I got three vice presidents. Can you get your man over there to show him his presentation? Yeah. So we head to Houston. I show it to these three VPs, and you can tell they're stunned. They're thinking, back then you didn't Photoshop things, but they're thinking, this can't be real. This, we know about this. So they wanted to drive and go see this. I said, hell, it'll take us 2 days. So Jim's standing there, and I said, Jim, you know your buddy Bob Bell has got golf trains, he's got that twin engine, that pilot. Let's get him and let's fly over it. And that's what we did. We got that damn twin engine plane, and we spent the day. And then they could see that it was for real, all right? Oh, that was on a Thursday. Sunday night, the president of the corn company in Milwaukee is in Highland Park, where Jack Bartholow is, spending the night. And they had me come over, show my dog and pony show. He said, and once I show, he says, I'll give you the machine with no recourse. And that's how we got. Now, this, the story ain't over. This, you won't believe what happened after this. Now, Texas Utilities, they want the machine. But I got the.
Texas Utilities?
This is Texas Utilities. We're going to provide. TXU. We're going to provide this machine to them for $30,000 a month for 6 months, you know, total of $108,000. If it works, they'll buy it for $500,000 where it was. Or don't we eat? We eat it. We think about it. Well, even though they're going to do all this, they got to go see a machine, all right, before they're going to do this. So the corn company arranges. They said, all right, we got some in Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania. So I get three TU people, and we fly to Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania to see this machine. Now, let me back up a little bit. The day or two or three before we go up there, in the front door walks the president of American Crane. And he tells my boss, and who was Jim Bryant, and he tells Jack Bartholow, we have just canceled American Crane dealer. Do you want the account? Well, man, that was a choice account, okay? American Crane. And they said, yeah. So the day I'm flying to Phillipsburg to look at this 1266 corn, they're flying to Minnesota, to wherever American Crane's headquarters is, to sign the deal. Well, the problem with that is American Crane and corn are competitors. It's like having Chevrolet and Ford in the same dealership. You can't have that, all right? I come back with an order, you know, after they see the, and I'm no longer the dealer. You with me? What's the chances of that happening? So I sit there for 30 days, and I'm gonna stay with Bartholow, but I'm trying to talk Jim. I said, Jim, I've been here 15 months now. And I said, I've been eating, I still had that restaurant, I'm eating out of that restaurant. And I said, I got to have some help. You've only paid me $200 a week. You know, I'm wearing my car out. I always said, you got to wait till the board, to the annual meeting. I said, Jim, I can't wait, man. I said, if you ain't impressed with what I done now, you ain't never going to be impressed. So when I realized he ain't going to pay, he's not going to come. I want $18,000 a year. I was getting 10 base. I walk out and I go home. And by this time, see, they have told Corin they're going to cancel him. I mean, in Corin's long face, you can imagine. You know, here Corin was going to get in this big account, Texas. Well, I knew where the line was going. It was going to go to Waukesha Parish out of Houston because they had everywhere but Dallas area, all right? You know, you've heard of WPI or Waukesha Parish Industries. They're a big machinery, oil field, premier outfit. They're going to celebrate their 100th birthday next year. So I knew Waukesha Parish was going to pick up the line in the Dallas territory that we had dropped. So when I walked out the door, I go home, pick up the phone and call one of these vice presidents and say, look, I've just quit. Bartholow, I want to go interview at Waukesha Parish in Houston. Can you get me an interview? And this is his exact words. He said, you goddamn right, I can get you an interview. You just sit by that phone, son. I hung that phone up. 30 minutes later, he called and said, can you be in Houston at 9 o'clock in the morning? I said, yes, sir. And I'm in Dallas at that time. So I'm in Houston, 9 o'clock. I get to Houston. At that time, I didn't realize how valuable I was. Right? I only been in the business at that point 15 months, you know. I get to Houston, there's three vice presidents waiting to see me. I show my dog and pony show, and these are all older guys. They said, can you wait here till we can get the Pierce boys in here to show this to them? The Pierce was the third, boys was the third generation. I'm 36, and they were younger than me. There's 34, 33, and 32. But they're being groomed. They got these titles, but they got older people coaching them. They bring them. I said, yeah, I'll be right. So we have to go come back and show my dog and pony show, and they want to hire me on the spot. At $24,000, and in 6 months, they raised me to $36,000. Had Jim Bright paid me $18,000, I never would have left him. So anyhow, we delivered the machine, you know, plus the next thing Tex Utility had on the list, they want a rubber tire machine, dozer that will push like a crawler. And the reason they want that is because these crawlers working up in this sand up here, it's just like valve grinding combine. They just melt away, all right? They're spending $50,000 a year per machine doing three undercarriages a year on one machine. That's just the tracks. That ain't the final drives, the transmission. That's just the tracks. Now, the cat dealer's smiling all the way to the bank, all right? But Texas Utilities is squealing like a pig hung in a gate. They said, we got to get us a rubber tire machine. So I go to work. Well, so happens Waukesha Parish has the Clark, Michigan line, and they make a rubber tire dozer. Now, this thing, the dozer is as big as a 10-yard loader. If you know anything about wheel loaders, that's a big machine, all right? Kind of like a Cat 988 or 992, all right? Well, we get one coming here. In fact, rig it up with Michelin tires, blade, ripper, the whole nine yards. And we start giving demos. I'm hauling that thing down to Rockdale, leave it there for a week, you know, whatever. Take it up to Tatum, leave it there a week, take it up to Mount Pleasant, leave it up there a week, you know, working with these guys three shifts a day. We wind up putting 600 hours on the hour meter on this thing, demoing it. No rental, this is a demo. Well, the bottom line was, it works good as long as you got a constant foot in, like in a fly ash or coal. But if you get over in the earth and reclaimed area, that four-wheel drive just goes to hell, all right? You know, it loses traction, blah, 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 blah. So that was out. And also, they wanted a big crusher. They had these loading silos that load the trains. The trains will go through that silo, and it'll load one every minute. And it'll load 19 cars, and they got an electric engine. And it goes over the power plant 10 miles away, dumps the load, comes back. And, well, when the silo breaks down, what the hell are they going to do? You see what I'm saying? So they wanted to set up an emergency loading situation that the silo break down, they could load these rail cars. The problem is they needed 1,500 tons an hour. That's a lot of coal because coal's bulky, right? Well, I had seen somewhere about this guy in Kentucky that had this Mighty Mike crusher that crushed 150 tons an hour. I called him, and he said, I'm going to be at the Detroit Coal Show. So I went to the Detroit Coal Show. This was between the time I was with Barthelow and the time I was with Pierce. And I met this guy, big, looked like Hoss Cartwright, and he had one of them there to show. I said, can you enlarge this to 1,500 tons, 10 times, 1,500 tons? He said, if you got the money, I can. I said, you need to come to Texas. So he flies into Texas, and we take him in to see Texas Utilities. This guy's got pork chop sideburns down to here and big old black hat, and he weighs about 350, 380. But he's a genius. You know, he's out of the hills. They have a car crushing operation in Kentucky, and they learn how to make crushers, and they learn how to handle stuff on belt. They can separate seat springs from rubber and glass and all that stuff. So, named Jim Pyle. So I take him, say, Jim, and Jim says, yeah, I can build you one. They want one, and they want it designed and built and delivered in 90 days. This is unheard of, all right? And he has about 100 employees, and he agrees to that. Takes Utilities, signs the deal. So we build that thing and deliver it during this period. WPI walks your peers. Now, yeah, here's another thing I did that's unusual. I know you can find this hard to believe. Now, here's Waukesha Pierce in Houston, headquarters, premier company, doing $100 million a year. They got stores in five states, but the oil field primarily. And they had got recently, in the last 10 years, in the construction business, you know. But they didn't know that much about it. They're not known. They're not very in the world. And they hired this outsider that was in construction business to run the construction division. And that's who I'm working for. But anyhow, get back to my story. Here you got this company in Houston. Now, this is before computers and Google search and all that stuff. Doing $100 million a year, a premier. Here you got a company in Dallas, Texas Utilities, doing a billion a year, and neither one of them's heard of each other. Now, that's hard to believe, right? This is 76. So Texas Utilities, you know, the only people they know is Caterpillar. The Cat dealers got them convinced that the only people that's big enough to service them is them, all right? So I said, I've got to convince TU in a hurry that there's some other body in town that can, you know, match Caterpillar. Well, WPI had three twin engine airplanes, two King Air 9s and a King Air 200. This is in 76. This is in a helicopter and three or four pilots. I tell the guys, that like it, this mine up here or the one at Fairfield, I say, all right, here's the deal. I would pick a day the Astros were playing, okay? I said, we're going to pick you up at the mine at 12 noon. We're going to fly you down to Sugar Land where the little airport is. We're going to come into Houston and take you to our main and waltz you through it and show you that there's somebody besides Cat. Then we're going to take you out to the Astrodome, the Astro Club, feed you a big steak, whatever you want. Watch a ball game, and we'll have you home by midnight. You're only going to miss a half a day's work. Well, how in the hell could you turn a deal like that down, you know? Within 30 days, I had 50 key people from TU, Texas Utility, all their minds, headquarters, waltzing through that. I mean, I brought everything up to speed quick, all right? What the next big thing I'm working on is Euclid. Texas Utilities run Euclid bottom dump trucks. Now this, they're hauling 100 tons. These are big trucks. 700 horse engines, aren't they? Running 24 hours a day. They got like 50 of them in their mines. The dealer is Conley Lott Nichols. Well, Conley Lott Nichols is getting fat off of this parts business, all right? Well, what happened was Colin Lott Nichols also had Terex. And the Terex people told Colin Lott Nichols, you got to make a decision. It's either us or Euclid. All right? Well, that time Robert Nichols was running. Colin Lott Nichols, he was the son of the founder, and he was a banker. He decided to stay with Terex. Well, that left Euclid up for grabs. And here they got 50 trucks out there, all this parts business. Well, but no one was talking about it. It was all hush-hush. But TU told me about it. They said, look, this divorce is coming. We're not talking about it because we want a smooth transition. He says, we need someone that's big enough to take care of our business. So I get a hold of the Euclid rep, man. I waltz him, you know, down to Houston, you know, and all of that. But the problem was this guy that was running the construction division, his executive vice president over construction, he was an egomaniac. And he didn't want me involved. He wanted, you know, the glory, right? So I'm trying to work around all this. Well, things are unfolding, and it's getting closer and closer to the announcement date that who they're going to announce, you know? Well, he figures, I've been about a year there, and he figures out some reason to run me off, all right? You know, purge me, in other words. And first, you're going to understand this. There's two, machinery salesmen are like football coaches. There's two kinds. Them that's been fired and them that's going to be fired, all right? And I've had more horses shut out for me under me at a full gallop than you can imagine, all right? So, yeah, he runs me off. Well, would you believe the next week they announce who they selected for the dealer? Now, this guy's assuming because Waukesha Pierce does $100 million a year, he's the only one that they can handle it, right? They picked some little dealer at that time. He wasn't that well known with Romco. But today, Romco's a big operator. They give it to Romco. It was a slap in the face.
All right? How do you spell that?
R-O-M-C-O, okay. Romco, premier outfit today. But what really made them was when they got in that mining business with that Euclid account. And what really had insult to injury, the guy who, and they didn't call this executive VP, I'm worried, they called the one over the engine division, all right, and told him. And they brought up in the same conversation, they said, we understand Mr. Cole is no longer with you. The fact they just brought my name up in the conversation was enough for me, all right. So anyway, I go to work for this wild man out of Kentucky, you know, the guy with the crusher. And he gives me a car to drive. He gives me a Cadillac. I said, Jim, I can't drive a Cadillac calling on public utility people in Texas. Oh, he said, that's all we got. In Kentucky, they all drive Cadillac. I'm driving. Well, after about 9 months, you know, Jim gets a chance. He gets a chance to bid on one of these permanent silos, you know, trade loading deal. Well, the problem with bidding on a $4 or $5 million deal, you got to have financial statements. You got to pass the financial test. Well, when they asked Jim for his financial statement, he produced them. My friends at TU said, Cole, this guy's broke. I said, I know that, but I said, I don't think he knew that until he produced his statement. So Jim's out, and Jim realizes that I can get him into bigger card games than he can play, okay? So he says, we shake hands, and he says, just keep the Cadillac until you find another job. I'm driving around Texas in this Cadillac, and unemployed, ain't got two quarters to rub between my hands. And I call a friend of mine. Now, I get to thinking, I say, now, who needs me? And Plains Machinery come to the top of the list because they had 10 branches. And they're not doing anything in the mining business. They don't even know how to get in the door, okay? Now, the problem with Plains, they had the International Harvester, you know, which that was their main line. That was, you know, and you can't get into mines with an International Harvester. So anyhow, I called a friend of mine that used to work for the forerunner of Plains Machinery called Brown Affairs. And I said, Roy, I want to go interview at Plains Machinery. Who do I talk to? He said, if you talk to anyone other than Morris Bailey, you're wasting your time. I said, who in the hell is Morris Bailey? He said, he's the president. So I said, how do I get to him? He said, let me make a call. Well, Roy used to work, and one of his buddies that worked with him at the Forerunner Planes was the manager of a plane store at Longview, Eddie Eisenhower. And Roy and Eddie were like this. They went fishing and Destin together with their wives. And so he calls Eddie and tells about me. And Eddie calls Morris and tells him, Morris and Amarillo. Morris says, have him in the Houston branch at 9 a.m. in the morning. Well, see, Plains is owned by Pioneer Gas, which is a $1 billion company, making $100 million a year, and they had 10 subsidiaries. Plains was one of them. They were our sugar daddy. They had like 3 Citation jets, all right? Now, Morris, the president of Cizier, he could get one of them when he needed it. So all he did was requisition that jet, and he's in Houston next morning. I'm there. I live in Houston, so I'm down at the branch. I show him this dog and pony show, I call it. He says, son, I want you to come down Amarillo, show this to the boys. Well, I don't know who the hell he's talking about. So sure enough, next week I catch Southwest Airlines. I'm up there and carry my slides and my projector and all that. My only suit I got on, I ain't got 2 bits to rub together in my pocket. And we get up there, and we're in this building. It's not Plains Machinery's building. It's another, it's kind of a 10-story building, maybe. It's Pioneer's. I'm not sure about all this, what's going on. And he's walking down the hall, and he's coming by this door, and somebody says, hey, Charlie, I want you to come see this. I think it's a clerk, you know. And he gets about 10 guys down this room down there with the chairman of the board, and I do my pony deal, and you can tell that they're stunned. Come to find out, I had like 10 vice presidents, you know, all these subsidiaries. I mean, I didn't know who they were at the time. But before I got back on the plane, I said, now, Morris, look, I want to go to work for you. If someone in Houston, I mean, in Dallas, wants to hire me, I'd rather work for you. It was the guy that wanted to hire me was Davis out of Fort Worth, the one that killed the basketball player that was dating his ex-wife. And we're going back in the 60s now, right? Cullen Davis, you probably heard of him. He's a famous, even millionaire, but anyhow, he got away with it. But he had to, at that time, I think he had the Komatsu dealership at Dallas.
Komatsu?
At that time, yeah. Now Waukesha Pierce has it, you know, at least everywhere but Dallas, maybe. But anyhow, so I said, here's the deal, Bailey. I said, I've shown you my deal. I said, I can't get you there with the International Harvester, but I can get you. Well, I'm going to bring to you D-Mag out of Germany. They're going to go where I go, all right? They were making a 16-yard excavator at that time, twice the size of the one that I introduced them. I said, I'm talking Melrose multi-wheel. They're rubber tire, chain-driven, big dozer. And then we'll get Wabco trucks. I said, those are 3 things that's going to get us in the mining business. I said, I'll give you 60 days to check me out. I'll fly with you anywhere you want to go, you know. Then the 60 days, if you like my game plan, I'll put on my quarterback uniform and I'll quarterback it for you. I said, it's going to cost you 10 grand. I want 5,000 now and I want 5,000 in 30 days. He said, son, you got a deal. So I come on home. And in the 60 days, we made a deal, and then we just clicking right along. And
so how'd you get hooked up with D-Mag?
Okay, when I put that coin in Texas, in the mines.
And spell that just for the record.
K-O-E-H-R-I-N-G. Okay. They were the premier hydraulic excavator dealers. See, Caterpillar wasn't just getting in that business, all right? American was just getting in. Corin dominated it, all right? Well, anyhow, by the time that Corin got in there and all the commotion it caused, people knew who I was, all right? And when I found out that D-Mag had come out with this world's largest 16-yard machine, I approached them and told, you know, they didn't know who I was. Somehow or another, I got to them and let them know who I was and convinced them that I told them I'm getting ready to hook up with somebody. Don't y'all make a deal with anybody and tell